Oh, man. Way too much fun on The Real Deal with Orbert Davis on 90.9 FM, WDCB, and WDCB HD1 in Glen Ellen. Well, you guys guessed it. You know what's happening right now. And I'm giddy, having way too much fun, sitting with a dear friend of mine, a musical genius, as you all know, especially those of you on the earth. Mr. Howard Levy. Howard, welcome to The Real Deal.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks, Orbert.
Well, I've been looking forward to this moment for a very, very long time, just to sit and talk music and all things Howard Levy. So,
not all things. Well,
most things, you know, a lot of things, you know. And I'm so glad that you brought your harmonica with you, or a little collection of harmonica. Well, the first thing when he opened his case, he said, "Well, I got harmonica in A, and every trumpet player's nightmare." Okay, yeah, let's just play in A. You know? So, but you just played the blues in B flat on an A harmonica.
Yeah. I just figured that's what you wanted to do, so I did it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, you know, this is a diatonic harmonica. It's those are the notes that exist on it.
Yeah.
But it's sort of, in a way, kind of like a trumpet or kind of like a trombone, in that there's a limited number of pure pitches available, and then you have to manipulate the airstream and the resonance of the inside of your mouth to achieve the rest of them. So if you have, for example, a hole here like that has an A and a B on it, you can bend the B down to B flat by moving your tongue back into your throat. It's kind of like a trombone in reverse.
Ah.
And so it has to do with the resonance of the inside of the mouth. And this is a byproduct of the nature of the instrument. The Germans who invented it in the 1820s had no idea that all these notes were available by bending. And they actually thought it was a defect, because sometimes people would play one of them and it would be out of tune, you know. So all the rest of those notes, the same deal. All those notes I get, it's sort of like little trombones, like I said.
Right.
In reverse. So to play in B flat on this instrument, I have to bend this
everything
except for the A.
Yeah, but when you're playing at lightning speed, then you're working up a storm there.
Well, I'm seeing it as a piano keyboard in my mind.
Okay,
and that's how I do it. It's mental visualization, because there's no fingerings involved. You're just holding this instrument that has reeds in it, and it's kind of like a trumpet where you have the three valves that lengthen and shorten the tube. But in my case, the valve is the inside of my mouth, you know, so the tongue, the resonance. And so I have this image of the keyboard that allows me to be there before I get there, you know. So I'm seeing the notes I'm going to play a fraction of a second before I play them.
Now, did you invent this technique?
Well, you know, not strictly speaking. I mean, the blues guys had been bending notes, you know, all that stuff for years, and playing the notes that the harmonica gives you for the blues, which is just amazing that it gives you the Mixolydian mode. And all that stuff.
Yeah.
But to actually focus on the pitches of those bends. All that stuff.
Yeah.
And use it more as a fully chromatic instrument was another story. And there were also six notes missing from the chromatic scale. And so when I was 18 and I started playing harp, and I had been playing piano for about 10 years at this point, I thought, what kind of instrument is this that has notes missing? I can't believe that they're not there. And I actually discovered how to play them.
Okay.
And people had squeaked out a few of these over the history of the instrument. There's one recording of a guy playing one from 1931, and I think another recording of someone playing one in 1970 or something. But this was 1969, 1970, and I discovered how to play all of them and have spent the rest of my life trying to just integrate it into every style of music possible and put this instrument into realms where it hadn't gone before.
Awesome. Well, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about was the fact that not only are you a multi-instrumentalist, you are a multi-genreist.
Yeah, that's true, really. So, it is true.
Tell us how that happened. I mean, where does that come from?
Well, you know, the first real musical inspiration, I started playing classical piano when I was a kid, when I was 8, and I started improvising right away. Mm-hmm. So I played that tune quite often.
He also plays the cell phone quite well, folks.
Man, it's pretty good. It's incredible. I have some chops on it. So I started improvising and listening to everything kind of, you know, as a sponge. I enjoyed lots of different things, but later I started getting into pop music and then blues. I heard some Chicago blues guys come to New York, which is where I'm from, Paul Butterfield, James Cotton, and this absolutely flipped me out. I thought, I got to learn how to play the blues. And I didn't grow up in a family that listened to blues and jazz. They listened to classical music and Broadway stuff, which I didn't realize was the foundation for jazz standards. So I was hearing a lot of this music that I'd later play. But then after that, I got into jazz through listening to John Coltrane's Crescent album. That was the first jazz I heard that really blew my mind. It was like a religious experience for me. So I just couldn't even imagine what these guys were doing. I listened over and over and over again, and I'm listening to the saxophone playing, which made like tears flow down my cheeks, you know, and the piano playing, which just astounded me, and the bass playing, which was incredible as well, and the drumming, which I couldn't even visualize. I mean, I had only seen rock drummers and listened to some very basic stuff. And how is this? What's this guy's name? Elvin Jones. But what? How does he do that? Does he have an extra arm or what?
Wow, yeah.
You know, so I looked around New York City, which is where I was living, like, and Coltrane had just died the year before.
So you're a teenager at this point.
Yeah, I was 17, I think.
Okay.
And Coltrane had died the year before. It was 1968. And I said, well, who's playing in town that's in this group? I looked and I saw that Elvin Jones was playing at the Museum of Modern Art Sculpture Garden. So I said to one of my friends who also was starting to get into this, hey, let's go hear Elvin Jones.
Oh, man.
And my first live jazz experience was Elvin Jones and Roland Kirk playing together.
Mm.
So that ruined me for life. It destroyed my teenage mind.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. So then you would play along with records and just pick things up?
Yeah. You know, I just listened and I had no idea how to learn this stuff. Mm-hmm. So I just thought, well, maybe if I, you know, like experiment on piano, I could do something kind of like this. And I started writing my own tunes inspired by this.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was the title track for the Tonight and Tomorrow CD.
Okay.
I started listening to a jazz radio station in New York called WLIB that the late, great Billy Taylor was the program director of.
Is that right?
And they played all the best jazz. There was a guy named Ed Williams who had a show called Maiden Voyage who played all the Blue Note stuff. And so I would listen to the radio and write down, oh, man, that was great. And I'd go to the record store in Greenwich Village called Dayton Records on A Street and buy it.
Wow.
And so I bought like all my first Blue Note albums there and Impulse Records at this record store. And I would go out to jazz clubs because they let me in when I was 17 or 18 in New York. They just said, sit there and drink a Coke. I didn't want to get drunk. I wanted to listen to the music. So I got to hear Herbie and Gary Burton and Roland Kirk and Elvin Jones and all sorts of people at the Vanguard and Mingus and Sonny Rollins and Dizzy and all these people and just all sorts of people. It's just the Thad and Mel Quartet. Bill Evans, and I mean, I can't even, you know, it's like a catalog of all the greatest jazz musicians in the late 60s and early 70s.
So when did you come to Chicago then?
Well, 1969, I went to school at Northwestern, And I stayed there for about a year and a half. And I got into the jazz band, even though I wasn't a music major. I just thought, hey, I play jazz piano. I mean, sort of.
What was your major then?
I didn't have one. I didn't stay long enough to have a major. But I went and tried out on piano for the jazz band. Okay. And that was led by Bunky Green and then by Rufus Reed.
Oh,
so I got to rub shoulders with two amazing jazz musicians. Yeah. And I was kind of intimidated and inspired. And I had never really understood. I'd never studied jazz. I never had a lesson or anything. So they stuck these parts in front of me that had all these cymbals on them.
Right.
You know, I mean, that I had never seen in classical music before, even just all the DSs and stuff. And I'm going, whoa, where do I go? And then all these chords that had numbers like 11 and 13. And it's like, wait a minute, there's only eight notes. And let me see, 9, 10, 11. Oh, the 11, oh, it must be the, oh,
yeah.
It's that. 13 is like, and what's this funny little zero with the slash through it and all that stuff? I had no idea.
Is that right?
So I had to ask questions and experiment. And then someone told me that modes were important. So I went to the library and got out a book on modes. And I just tried to, you know, learn by the seat of my pants, which is what I've mostly done.
But, you know, I think self-discovery is a part of the jazz process anyway.
Yeah.
You got to own it.
And the big band thing is, you know, it's something that everyone learns in that. I'd say pianists learn a little bit less in a certain way than horn players, because the horn players are really the heart of a big band.
Mm-hmm.
But piano players can learn the sounds and those giant voicings that are going on around them.
Right.
And you have to learn how to sort of wade through the minefield of a piano chart. You know, you look at a Thad Jones piano chart and it's got every single chord in it, and you learn after a while, like, maybe you're not supposed to play all those. Maybe the band's playing those and you just, like,
there
interject.
You
and, you know, I'm happy that I got a chance to do that. And then, of course, later I played with the Jazz Members Band, which was the...
Oh, that's right.
I did that quite a bit. And Chicago has been was an amazing learning territory for me.
And I was going to ask you, why did you stay?
I came back. I went back to New York for a year and a half.
Okay.
And New York in the early 70s was insanity. It was like an endless Kojak episode. It was so dangerous, and there were so many crazy people wandering around. It was something, you know, I grew up there and I thought it was normal,
right.
But it had gotten worse, and I had never lived in Manhattan. It was my dream. I had grown up in Brooklyn and Queens. So I went back and lived in Manhattan, and that cured me of living in New York for a while. And me and a lot of other people too.
Wow.
It was just, you know, really dangerous. But, you know, New York has a kind of thing that no place else has. And so I carry that inside me.
There you go. Well, you mentioned earlier about writing as a teenager. And before we got on the air, you were talking about some pieces that you revisited and rewrote from your childhood.
Yeah.
Let's have an example of that.
Oh, okay. Well, the title track from Tonight and Tomorrow. And I wrote that in my parents' living room, the first part of it when I was 18. And then I wrote the second part of it in one of my apartments I lived in as a freshman at Northwestern when I was 19. And on the Trevor CD, Telegram of Love is one that I wrote when I was living in New York when I was 19, pretty much as is.
Oh, my goodness.
But I was waiting for a band to play it. And when I joined Trevor in 1979, by I think 1981, we were starting to play some of my tunes.
Okay, well, let's check out the Chevrolet de Chicago. Okay, this is Telegram of Love from Chevrolet de Chicago. We're talking to Howard Levy on The Real Deal with Orbert Davis on 90.9 FM WDCB. Thank you. was Telegram of Love with our guest, Howard Levy, on The Real Deal with Orbert Davis. And that was performed by one of your projects, I'll call it.
Yeah.
You have tons of projects, Howard.
I do.
Chevrolet de Chicago. And I love this group because I would say that every member of this band I have a long history with as well.
You know,
dear friend from a long time, especially working in Chicago studios a few years ago. Tell us a little bit about Chevrolet. How did it come about?
Well, Alejo Poveda, the drummer, who was born in Costa Rica, he founded the group as a percussion ensemble to play the music of the Caribbean and South and Central America in 1975, I think. And then they gradually added some melodic instruments. And I had really missed playing this kind of music, being a New Yorker in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to hear the band play, and I just had to play with them, you know. So I asked them if I could sit in, and then one thing led to another, and I joined the bands in 1979. And then I started bringing some of my compositions in because some of the stuff I wrote when I was younger seemed like it fit this band perfectly, and we started playing a bunch of my tunes and eventually recorded them on the band's first and only CD, which was released in 2005, maybe?
Yeah, not that long ago.
Yeah.
So the band, I mean, I can imagine that the band didn't play that much because all you guys are touring musicians and very busy. How often did the band work?
Well, we used to play a lot more in the 80s in Chicago. We played all the time. We played a lot of the clubs in town and some of the, you know, like Chicago Jazz Festival and Chicago Fest and stuff like that. But as guys started getting busier and touring more often with national acts, it became more and more difficult. So now we play maybe like four times a year or something like that.
Wow, and it's the original band, right?
Well, not totally. I mean, there are some other members of the band who have left and passed on, even have passed away because it's been together for, oh my God, what is it, 35 years? So even longer. But it's the core of the band is pretty much the same. We've been through several bass players, but boy, Eric Hochberg's been there a long time.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And we can drop some more names. Ruben Alvarez.
Yes.
And Mark Olson.
Joe Rendon, fantastic conga player. fantastic. And Mark Olson on trumpet. Steve Eisen, who's one of the really greatest saxophone players I've ever heard. And
flute
as well. He's amazing. And he was in the band right from the beginning, actually.
Yeah.
They let him play. And he's a really good conga player as
I know.
Well.
Yes, and so he plays conga as well in the group?
He used to, but not anymore. Everyone, Chicago Hambone, Chris Cameron, who's an amazing B3 player, and an incredible persona.
That's what I find striking in the instrumentation when you think in terms of the music of the Caribbean and Latin-inspired jazz. Then there's this Hammond B3 organ and harmonica.
Yeah, you know, and I'm mostly playing piano, but it's got a very strong Chicago flavor. There's a lot of bluesiness in the band, as well as the fact that we are one of the few bands like this that is not a salsa band. I mean, we play Afro-Cuban jazz, but we also play a lot of Brazilian-influenced jazz. We have equal amounts of both, which is very rare, and we play what we love.
Sure. And one more name, Ernie Dinoff.
Oh, Ernie, I forgot. Oh, my God. Yeah, Ernie's an amazing guitar player and also a great composer who wrote the title track of the CD.
Awesome, Secret Dream. Well, folks, you got to get this. It's in my collection, I'm telling you. So let's talk about some of your other projects. Just recently, Trio Globo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where did that come from?
Trio Globo is a group that I joined right after I quit the Flecktones the first time, the beginning of 1993. It's Glenn Velez, who's an amazing percussionist, and Eugene Friesen, who's an incredible cellist. And both of them are great composers and musical minds. Gene teaches at Berkeley. Glenn is the foremost frame drummer in the Western Hemisphere. You know, he's reintroduced the frame drum to Western culture, I'd say, single-handedly, although he does play with two hands.
Wow.
So we have been together now for 20 years and put out two of my favorite CDs in the 1990s, and we just put out two more. one of them is called Steering by the Stars, which the title track I composed, but it has, of course, music composed by Glenn and Eugene on it as well, and I love playing their tunes even more than I like playing my own, to tell you the truth.
Right? So how does this work? So you're in Chicago, and one of the guys are in Berkeley and Boston, right?
Yes.
And where?
Glenn lives in New Jersey.
Glenn's in New Jersey. How do you say,
it's difficult.
Hey guys, let's rehearse, you know, my garage, you know, 4 o'clock, let's go.
It's really hard. I mean, in the past I toured a lot and I would be on the East Coast more and we'd get together.
Yeah.
We flew them out to Chicago to record the CD at CRC Studios, actually.
Oh, yeah.
With Chris Steinmetz, who did a fantastic job engineering and co-producing it. And one of the things I'm really proud of on the CD is that we do two covers. It's the first time we've covered anybody else's material, and they were recorded in the same session. One of them is Giant Steps, and the other is This Land Is Your Land.
Oh, man.
Which I don't think that Coltrane and Woody Guthrie have ever been recorded in the same recording session before.
They've never been in the same sentence before.
And this version of Giant Steps is something that I'm particularly proud of because I've been working on it for years. It's one of those things that it is a musical conundrum. I mean, Coltrane devised it as part of his exploration of this whole symmetry that he had come upon in various places and was applying it to a lot of different pieces of music, some standards first, and then he composed a whole bunch of other tunes using this root movement of minor third and fourth, when you examine this tune, it is symmetrical in every aspect. The bass line can continue in whole steps downward, and the melody is alternating major thirds and minor thirds, and the 2 5s are actually interruptions of the cycle of minor third, perfect fourth.
Right.
I've made a study of this for like 30 years. I've been trying to figure it out. And it finally kind of gelled and crystallized. And with this group, I also decided that we should play it in some different rhythms because we like to explore rhythm. So it starts out in a rocky rhythm called a Georgina, which is in 10-8, which Glenn and I have played a lot with Middle Eastern musicians. Uh-huh. And then I solo in 5-4, and then we go into 7-8, and I solo in that, and then we finish in 9-8.
Okay,
These are Bulgarian rhythms.
We got to stop and listen to it. There's no other way. My brain is like in overload now. My feet are tapping, and I'm ready to hear it. Well, here's Howard Levy and his super group, Trio Globo, with John Coltrane's Giant Steps, as you've never heard it before.
Thank you.
This is 90.9 FM WDCB, and you're tuned to The Real Deal with Orbert Davis. I know many of you are going to hear this on the podcast because I think we're having a classic conversation here, Howard. I'm sure learning a lot, and I'm going to force 1,000 students to listen to this this show.
Thank you.
They've got to hear what we've just heard in giant steps. Holy cow. Actually, I'm very interested to see your notes on your discovery of giant steps. I think that's phenomenal.
You know, something I think I might try to present someplace. You know, it's because it's like a musical fractal. That the more you examine it, the more you find symmetry in every aspect of it. And once you start understanding that, then it frees you up to play things over it that are not just the transcription of Coltrane solo, you know?
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. So a while ago, about a year ago, we interviewed Victor Wooten on The Real Deal. And, of course, your name came up a couple times. And talk a little bit about your experiences with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. You're one of the founding members?
Yes. I met Bela at a festival in Canada, the Winnipeg Folk Festival. And we got together and jammed for about 6 hours in my room. And it was really an amazing feeling. And I said, hey, man, keep me in mind. Don't forget about this. Let's do something. So we started out playing on a TV show in Louisville. And I mean, I don't know if Victor told you about the rehearsal.
No.
Or lack of. Yeah, I flew down to Nashville to Bela's house, and there was a power failure. Because Bela had told me, I had met Victor and heard him, and it was unbelievable. But I had no idea about the drummer. And so I walked in Bela's house, and there's Roy, a future man, standing there holding this weird-looking thing. It looks like it came from a science fiction movie.
Right.
Except the power was out. And so I couldn't hear it. I said, what the heck is that? So we said, well, look, we got to rehearse. Those guys had been rehearsing. I just had flown in. I had never played with them before. And so Roy started playing on a chair, and Victor tuned a guitar down and started playing on the bottom four strings. And we just went, you know, let's just drive to Louisville, and we're going to rehearse tomorrow at soundcheck. And that was it. I mean, we had this brief run-through of the tunes with the lighting adjustments and stop and move this light and turn up this monitor, and that was it. We played the TV show, and people flipped out, and that's how the band started. So I played with them for about 4 years and did 3 records with them, and records, listen to me, CDs.
Hey.
The first one's actually available on vinyl, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, got nominated for a bunch of Grammys. It was a thrilling development in my life, but it was so full-time, and it seemed like it was never going to end. I just needed a break from it.
Wow. So it put you on the national stage then?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. I mean, I had been playing with Paquito de Rivera before that, and that was sort of the first step in having people becoming more aware of me in the mid-'80s. But this was a different magnitude. I mean, this was something. We were on all these national TV shows, Tonight Show and Arsenio Hall. Remember Arsenio?
Yeah.
Yeah, all sorts of shows. And it was great. I mean, it was a thrilling experience. But I just didn't want to play 130 of those every year for the rest of my life. It just felt confining in a certain way. And I just wanted to break free of that. And then I went ahead and just did all sorts of other stuff, which, you know, the rest of my life started.
But again, what I find remarkable, because I think during those times, that's when we met and see you in the studios. And, you know, you would always bring a sense of high level of musicality and joy to every session.
Oh, man. Thank you, Herbert.
Really cool.
Thank you. I miss sessions.
Yeah, right. Talk about the old days.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. So we talked about, you know, okay, so you're multi-genre. This is actually a personal question in terms of, I know what it takes to kind of just keep the trumpet warm, and occasionally I try to take it to another level, which is, you know, a few hours a day. How in the world are you able to be such a multi-instrumentalist and be at the top of your game on each instrument?
Well, I quit playing a bunch of them.
Okay.
Because I used to play a lot more, you know, and part of my thing was I wasn't like one of those keyboard players who got into synths and let me try to sound like 15 instruments on a keyboard. I was one of those guys who listened to instruments and said, I'd like to learn how to play that instrument.
Nice.
Which is why I learned saxophone and mandolin and flute and all those other things. And a lot of percussion instruments like mallets and dumbek and, you know, things like this. I wanted to make the sounds that turned me on musically.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time doing that at various times of my life. I spent a lot of time playing saxophone for a number of years. But I just realized at a certain point that the piano and the harmonica were the ones that I really, really wanted to get great on. And in order to do that, I really had to let go of the other ones, even though I really loved all of them. And some of them are still in my closets at home, my old tenor and, you know, the soprano. But I tried to put all of those things that I learned on those other instruments into my harmonica playing, especially. Wow. And into the, you know, being inspired by the greatest things you can hear and other people have played on all those instruments. And that I have an inside understanding of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, man. I'm just spellbound by it. And then one thing that you do, which I, again, find phenomenal, is that you play harmonica and piano at the same time.
Yeah, that started as a necessity when I was in the Flecktones because I worked out all these arrangements where I was going to be, you know, doing both of those things. And I remember in rehearsals, I felt like smoke was coming out of my ears after a while sometimes. Like, hey, guys, you got to stop. I can't think anymore because I'm playing a D-flat harmonica and piano at the same time, and I can't figure out what key I'm in anymore. Like, just I need to walk around the block. But I got better at that, even though the G harmonic is the one I see most directly as a piano one-to-one. And I've recorded a bunch of things. Matter of fact, on my Alone and Together record, there's one really cool track called Ornette in the AM. I think I was wearing my bathrobe. I have a great Steinway at home, and I just set it up to record at one point. And I was just recording every day, and this one was even before breakfast. I had a coffee to maybe just water, and I had the mic for the harmonica at the piano. And I was holding the harmonica in one hand and playing bass lines on the piano in the other hand and just thinking about Ornette, who is also one of my, you know, I mean, what can you say?
Yeah.
You know?
Unbelievable. Wow. Well, we have to hear it. Before we hear it, I want to talk about this whole aspect of, you seem, in your composition, you seem to be very programmatic in a sense that, you know, your titles are based on life experiences and
sometimes,
and so on. Sometimes, yeah.
Sometimes. I mean, this, I was trying to figure out what the heck to call it, and I'm thinking about Ornette, you know, so I better mention him, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want to pretend I'm not thinking about him.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Here's Ornette in the AM. Howard Levy, our special guest for this hour of The Real Deal with Orbert Davis. Thank you. That was Ornette in the AM, our special guest on this hour of The Real Deal with Orbert Davis, Mr. Howard Levy. Howard, that was fun.
Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. So one hot topic that everyone has to talk about, cannot avoid in the world of jazz, is simply education. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the future in terms of jazz education?
You know, I'm a funny guy to ask that because I never had a jazz lesson. You know, I pretty much just taught myself just from necessity and incredible desire to play the stuff that inspired me. I wish I had had teaching. I think everyone has to find the right teacher for themselves. Because if you're born, if you have the soul of an improviser, this is the thing, you know, jazz can't be taught to everybody.
Yeah.
Not everyone is equipped to be a jazz musician. I mean, even if you're playing in a big band, you have to feel the swing and you have to feel the lines as if you were playing them as a solo. It's not just a section, you know, part. There's a personality that's involved. I think for kids to really get it, they have to come in contact with jazz musicians who are players and go to hear guys live and see what people look like who are playing this music and the body language and the attitude, and then they're going to get it. It's nothing you can learn from reading a book or even listening to recordings. That's partial. Right. Or having a teacher teach you how. Of course, you have to learn your instrument. And all the guys in the past who were really great players all studied their instruments with really fine teachers. The teachers didn't necessarily teach them how to play jazz.
Right.
They taught them their instruments. And so I would recommend the highest level technically possible for people who are young people who want to learn jazz, is they have to understand their instrument and learn music theory and transpose things to all 12 keys. Even if they're learning how to play Mary Had a Little Lamb, play it in all 12 keys, mm-hmm. and that loosens up your mind. Transposition, to me, is the key to improvisation and freedom in music. And another thing that I firmly believe is rhythmic transposition, I call it, playing a piece in different time meters. I mean, if you have a tune just like a standard blues, you can play it in 5/4, you can play it in 7/4, you could try to play it in 9/8, you can try to play it in 11, you know, play it as a waltz. Mm-hmm. To learn how to phrase and to test out your improvisational skills in these different time meters. And develop a vocabulary for improvisation in all 12 keys and in every possible time meter so that you're surrounding the music.
Right.
These are things I could recommend definitely that I know that have worked for me.
Awesome. So you have a harmonica school. Does
yes.
that mean, do you teach privately or how does that work?
Well, I do, but I have an online harmonica school, which is through a company called Artist Works, based in Napa, California. It's an amazing company. They have about 25 teachers in all genres of music, which is one of the great things about it. Bluegrass and classical and jazz and rock. They have John Patitucci teaching jazz bass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't have saxophone players yet or trumpet players. They have a classical trumpet player.
Okay.
But they got me to teach harmonica, which I was skeptical of. Harmonica lessons online.
Yeah.
The reason I was skeptical is you can't see anything that I'm doing. It's
oh,
on camera.
Yeah.
It's like I hold the harmonica, and I don't know if you guys on the radio can see this, but as soon as I hold it, it disappears.
It does.
You can't see it. And I told them, I said, I'm not sure, but it really, really does work. It's a fantastic platform they developed. It's very interactive. I have some pre-recorded lessons, hundreds of them, and they also, students can send me a video of something they're working on, and I will answer it with a critique of my own, and the two are paired together as a mini masterclass that everyone at the school can watch.
Oh, nice.
So there's an actual sense of community. Yeah. People can make comments. They can communicate with each other. There are forums for discussing any topic that is of any interest to anyone.
Wow.
Interviews that I've done with musicians. I did one with Bela, actually, which was really cool.
Nice.
Not
nice.
Just harmonica players.
Yeah.
It's a very wonderful thing. I have several hundred members right now from all over the world.
And then, of course, you meet them live as you travel, and they'll come up and say, hey, remember me?
Yes, and one of them is in Chicago right now. He happens to be the pianist for the Simon Bolivar Orchestra in Caracas, and he's a great harmonica player.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very excited to meet him because that's an amazing organization. Talk about education, the thing that they do in Venezuela. is mind-boggling. That is funny. I'm hopefully going to meet him today if I have time, or if not, in a few days from now.
Well, awesome. You have to tell me about that.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, there you have it, Mr. Howard Levy. I am just so excited. I'm sitting here as his student.
No.
Oh, man, I'm learning so much. Thank you so much, Howard, for coming in and for joining us and just sharing your wisdom and your life. This is The Real Deal with Orbert Davis. And we have a lot more music to come tonight and a lot more interviews. Just make sure you hit us up on Facebook, like us, or visit our website, therealdealjazz.com. So a special thanks to our guest, Mr. Howard Levy. And I thought we'd end this hour with one of the pieces that he described that got him going as a young musician, John Coltrane's Crescent. Thanks again, Howard.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.